may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble, you might like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. You're gonna have to serve somebody.
Somebody.
Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
You might be a rock and roll addict, prancing on the stage. You might have drugs at your command, women in a cage. You may be a businessman or some high degree thief. They may call you doctor, or they may call you chief, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
The legendary Staples Singers family, Mavis Staples, with a Bob Dylan classic, You Gotta Serve Somebody. This is from her 1999 album, Tangled Up in the Blues, Songs of Bob Dylan. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and you know, today, the report is out. Of course, being almost 400 pages, it goes without saying, haven't had time to read it all and understand it all, but we are going to discuss a subject parallel to it. So we're not going to get into the report itself until we've had a chance and you've had a chance to read the report or to read a report of the report, so that when we discuss it, we have a good point of reference. But in this report, and it should be clear, because the president is making a victory dance all over the place, saying that he's exonerated by the report, that the report finds that he didn't do anything wrong. That's not what the report says. The report says that essentially the president is not exonerated in his actions with regard to the two counts that special counsel Robert Mueller had taken a look at, him and his team. One was obstruction of justice, and one other count was regarding collusion in order to influence the outcome of the 2016 election. So bear that in mind, even as you may watch television and you may watch reports about the report, that Mueller was very, very clear. The president is not exonerated. And further, at least from my reading of the synopsis, it seems to suggest that Mueller says, I've gone as far as I could go, given my instructions, what the scope of the investigation was to be. I have done all I could do within those parameters. Now, it is up to Congress to take it from here. And that is a very, very serious implication. Mueller is not saying that the president is not guilty of any crimes. He says, that was not within my purview to determine whether he committed crimes or not. That will be best determined, he said, by Congress as a whole, evaluating the evidence that has been produced in connection with the report, because the Congress now will have to make a determination as to whether, based on constitutional law, the president, in fact, did commit crimes, and crimes that are impeachable. All right, so we leave it right there. Just keep in mind, don't get all excited about whatever it is that is being covered as news and the president is doing a victory dance. There's no victory here yet. And it has several more permutations to go, this investigation, before it actually comes to a definitive end. But what we are going to talk about today is that a familiar name popped up in the report, and familiar to those who have been following the Clintons. And the person best qualified to speak in this regard is our guest, Charles Ortel. Charles Ortel, you know, as you know, has been a nemesis of a whistleblower looking at the ways in which the Clintons operated what the eponymous foundation, the Clinton Foundation, as we call it for short, but it's properly called the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation. And in that regard, we have a name popping up in this report that also popped up last Thursday in court, in which this person was indicted for lying. And this person enjoyed a very high profile within the Clinton Foundation, the Clinton administration, I should say. And so it is very interesting how Washington works. It is a swamp. I talked some time ago, you may recall, about sinkholes and swamps. Well, I don't know whether we can say this is, he's from the sinkhole or he's from the swamp, but he is from that part of Washington, D.C. that we seldom see or hear about. These people are quite invisible, earning a lot of money, involved at the highest levels in policy making. But Charles is with us today to give us an idea of why it is in the middle of a discussion about Donald Trump, this person's name pops up. Hello, Charles.
Hello, Yatrice. How are you?
Okay. How are you doing?
I'm just fine, thanks. I hope you can hear me clearly.
I can hear you very clearly, even with a kind of basso profundo voice today. Very good acoustics. All right, so who is this person? And why are we supposed to pay attention to his name?
You're talking about Greg Craig?
Yes.
Yeah. So he was indicted for failing to register under, just characterizing the indictment, not trying to recite it word for word, but for failing to register under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, for taking money to advance the interests of a foreign party. And you have to, this Foreign Agents Registration Act has not been vigorously enforced since its original promulgation into law in 1938. But the basic idea of it, if you read in the history of it, and there's quite a lot online and elsewhere about it, in 1938, the United States was not yet at war. In World War II, and there were concerns. I mean, my own family came from, actually, Prussia in 1853. So there were concerns about whether there were sleeper enemies lurking inside inside the United States who might act for the Nazis against the interests of the people of the United States. So they promulgated this act and forced, and they have a very tight definition of who would have to register and what sort of information would have to be provided. And this gentleman was indicted for failing to comply with that act and for other reasons. And this is no ordinary human being. This is a gentleman who is about 75 years old, who is an eminent person at Harvard, where he went undergraduate. I believe he hailed originally from Vermont. And when he went to Harvard, he was very active in the anti-Vietnam War movement, and very prominent on the Harvard campus. In fact, in Wikipedia, it refers to him as one of the most quoted and visible student leaders fighting against America's role in the Vietnam War. He then went on to Yale Law School. After Harvard, he went to England on a Harvard fellowship to England. I think it's studying at Cambridge. And from there, he ended up at Yale Law School, where he was in the same law school class with time with Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, and the very famous lawyer David Kendall, who we know for his work. And he's a partner at Williams & Connolly, the very powerful firm, principally based in Washington, D.C. So these guys all meet at law school. They go through that formative experience. They're all anti-war people, with the exception of Hillary. They and others have been over in England on fellowships. They think they're going to remake the world in their image. They get involved in first practicing law. This fellow, Craig, ends up being a partner with Kendall at Williams & Connolly. And indeed, the two of them ultimately get involved. They maintain a close friendship and association. They get involved defending Bill Clinton against the impeachment. They're successful in that. This fellow, his firm, Williams & Connolly, this is where it starts dovetailing with the work I've been doing. Williams & Connolly also happens to be the firm that incorporates the William J. Clinton Presidential Foundation on October 23rd, 1997. So that's right before the impeachment, actually the revelations about Monica Lewinsky even surface. And so why I think this is very interesting is that on October 23rd, 1997, or October 1997, if you go back into the public history, those were dark days for the Clintons. Revelations about their legal expenses were gigantic. They had no assets to speak of. Hillary couldn't really earn money outside of the White House. Bill was limited to his presidential salary, which was very modest. I think it was only $200,000 back then. And his legal bills, their legal bills, had already, because of Whitewater and other things, gone into many millions of dollars. And I think one of the things that's going to come out of all this, it's going to take months, maybe years for us to see it, is that the law firm of Williams & Connolly and another law firm, Skadden Arps, where Craig subsequently, you know, left to become a partner there, those firms were owed millions of dollars and were the principal beneficiaries of the Clinton Legal Expense Trust, version 1 and version 2. So I've checked with many lawyers, and I know from personal experience, when you have a big partnership and you've got clients that you're defending, and especially if it goes into criminal matters, you don't take credit risk. You don't say, "Oh, sure, I'll let Utrecht or Charles run up a $10 million legal bill and take throw the dice as to whether or not I get convicted." Because if I get convicted, you know, chances are I'm not going to earn money sufficient to pay off that bill. You don't take that risk. Very often, what you do is you say, what I'm going to do is I'm going to require an upfront deposit, or I'm going to require guarantors. And yet, in this case, Williams & Connolly and Skadden Arps did not do that, it seems. They said, "Wait a minute, you know, we'll just let you're the President of the United States, and you know, you're a friend, and Hillary's our friend, so we'll roll the dice." At a certain point, that, in my mind, becomes a gift or a gratuity, or it's a different treatment than, you know, a standard client of Williams & Connolly would get. And at a certain point, you go from being an independent lawyer, counsel to your client, to potentially getting involved in a conspiracy. And a conspiracy that might, you know, actually become a very serious, I think will become a very serious problem here, is that Williams and Connolly, the public record shows that Williams and Connolly and the other law firm that Bruce Lindsay, close Clinton confidant and then employee in the White House, his firm, Wright, Lindsay, and Jennings, were the firms that, in my view, illegally incorporated the Clinton Foundation on October 23rd, 1997, without creating a straight-up organization, an independent entity not run by partisan supporters of Bill Clinton and Hillary. Not going to, the record is very clear. They did not obtain the corporate equivalent of the Social Security number, which is called a Federal Employer Identification Number, for this entity until they sought such a number on the 23rd of December, 62 days after it was incorporated in Little Rock. They conducted extensive activities in Little Rock without having that corporate required number, including convincing the city of Little Rock to pass more than five resolutions in which, on one of them, they cite that Bill and Hillary Clinton had selected a specific site in Little Rock as being the site for the presidential center. Well, Bill and Hillary Clinton are not in any paperwork having to do with organizing this entity at any time until, in the case of Bill, later on in September 29, 2009, in the case of Hillary, not until April time frame 2013. So way back in 1997, Bill and Hillary Clinton had no authority whatsoever to bind this organization that really wasn't a formal organization. And stuck in the center of all this is Williams and Connolly, and specifically David Kendall, who has subsequently become, you know, one of the most important, he's now, I think, of counsel to Williams and Connolly, but he was one of the most prominent partners at Williams and Connolly. He was, you know, he's very active in any Clinton controversy. Now what you're doing here in this latest indictment, to bring it about, around here, is you're indicting one of David Kendall's, you know, close associates. And the response to the indictment was very interesting to me in that this gentleman, Mr. Craig, or his counsel, disclosed that the person who had paid him to engage in this activity was none other than somebody called Victor Pinchuk, who is listed as a donor to the Clinton Foundation of the tune of $10 to $25 million. And, you know, maybe I've got this wrong, but I'm reading this as saying that Craig is saying, listen, I'm 75 years old. I know a lot. Okay, I'm not going down alone. If you keep going after me here, you know, I'm going to be forced to reveal what I do know about the inner workings of the Clintons going all the way back probably to 1997.
What do you see as a common thread here between, well, I know that you're familiar with Flynn, who was with the Trump administration. And do you see any parallels here between Greg Craig and Flynn?
Well, Greg Craig and Flynn. So Greg Craig is a far more powerful person than Flynn ever was. You know, Greg Craig had Bill Clinton's, he represented Bill Clinton's interests, right? And he's a member of the bar. And a prominent one at that. And he's been doing this for a long time. Michael Flynn, I don't know how well Flynn and Trump knew one another. And Michael Flynn is a decorated military veteran. But, you know, he didn't go to college with Donald Trump. He didn't go to law school with Donald Trump. He, you know, he's not a decades-long associate of Donald Trump in the way that this guy Craig is. I would say, if you're going to draw a contrast like that, a more interesting contrast would be to draw a contrast between the way in which Ken Starr acted and the way in which President Clinton acted when he was under investigation by Starr and subsequently through impeachment. I draw a contrast there with Donald Trump and Robert Mueller. What's really interesting, it's very important for our audience here to understand that what happened to Clinton happened at a time when there was a completely different statute, Ken Starr wasn't truly independent counsel. That was a statute that was signed into law that created these independent counsels. And there was a hue and cry, bipartisan hue and cry, actually, saying that this is really dangerous. You give somebody like Ken Starr or any other independent counsel the ability to function above, outside the control of the president, the executive branch, or the judicial branch, you're going to have some, you could make a mistake in doing that. And you could create, and some people hate Ken Starr, you could create somebody that's Frankenstein, right? So in response to what happened there, Ken Starr issued his report, it immediately went public, okay? They created, they let that statute expire afterwards, and they created the new statute under which Robert Mueller has been appointed, not as an independent counsel, but as a special counsel. And as a special counsel, he reports to, ultimately, to the attorney, to the attorney general. And the statute was changed, not that the special counsel would release a report immediately to the public or to Congress, but that the special counsel would release it to the attorney general, and that it would be a confidential report at that moment, which was then left up to the discretion of the attorney general to decide, should we make it public or not. So Trey Gowdy, who's an experienced prosecutor, his viewpoint was that actually the correct thing for Barr to have done would be to say, no, I've read the report, I made my decision, and I'm not going to make it public. Well, that's not what Barr did. He released this report. No one really has read it thoroughly, perhaps other than the people who wrote it and maybe the president's lawyers. But I'm not going to try to nitpick the report in detail, you know, without having said several days to think about it. But that's an important set of differences. The second set of differences, if we remember back in the Bill Clinton period, the Clinton team, and in particular Bruce Lindsay, was centrally involved in all this, a guy who ultimately gets transplanted into the Clinton Foundation. They asserted every single conceivable privilege, not just executive privilege and attorney-client privilege, they even made up privileges. And in contrast here, what we've been told, and we'll have to verify it, is that President Trump did not assert executive privilege at any point and cooperated. Now, some might say not as much as you like, but he did not assert attorney-client privilege, we're told. And there were no redactions that were requested by President Trump's team in this report we'll eventually see. So, there's a huge hue and cry here. I want to make sure that what Bill Barr and I went to the same high school. He's about 6 years older than I am. My high school, fellow high school alumnus, you know, I want to make sure that what he said in the press conference is borne out by what we see in the actual report. But I was heartened by the fact that he started out and he said, listen, we have no evidence of any collusion with the Russian government or elements of the Russian government involving any American. He said that several times. I want to see if that's actually in the report. Okay, if after spending however many months this is, 22 months or thereabouts, on this project, a team of, you can't say it was a bipartisan team, this is a team of Trump haters. A team of Trump haters could not find, you know, that raked Jerry Corsi over the coals, that raked Manafort, maybe justifiably or not, over the coals. If they could not find any evidence of collusion, which, by the way, isn't a crime, with involving any American, and that's in the report, you know, then you have to, at least I have to have a bit of sympathy for somebody, team who says, look, we didn't do this, and somehow this investigation got started, you know, is this a just investigation or is it an unjust investigation? You know, it's a fair question. And I'm not sure if I had been president of the United States and I knew that I and nobody on my team had colluded with Russia and this thing happened, you know, I'm not so certain that I would have been as cooperative as giving 1.4 million documents and letting this take 22 months. 22 months is a long time.
But at the same time, he is president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And he needs to communicate to the people that he has nothing to fear. So he has to cooperate. At the same time, I would say that we have to look at the the role of Congress here that seems to be pretty confusing as to who ultimately has authority here. Now, first you had Mueller. Mueller takes over. He's given free rein. He's given the charge of undertaking an investigation, which he does. Why is it that Congress was so, although it insisted that it suspected that Trump, in fact, was guilty of these crimes, why didn't Congress become more proactive in this investigation?
So I'm not a lawyer, but I consult with lawyers, and I believe I know that this is the correct analysis. In the first instance, one of the things that does actually make America retain greatness, with or without Trump, is that under the American system of justice, which is not exactly the same as the UK, but born out of the UK experience, you are indeed innocent until proven guilty. Right? The standard isn't that some prosecutor, let's call him Giuliani, wakes up in the morning as a special counsel and decides that he has a right to investigate Eutrice Leed, and that you then spend 22 months of your life answering any question on any topic that he cares to ask you, dealing with FBI agents asking you those questions where it's a crime to lie to an FBI agent, and you make a mistake and they trap you and you're done. That's not our system. Our system is you have to find evidence of a crime. You then have to decide, as prosecutors, is there sufficient evidence and context here to give you high confidence? And in the case of somebody like Craig or the Clintons or these, you know, very prominent people, extraordinarily high confidence that when you charge somebody like a Craig or you charge Hillary Clinton or you charge Donald Trump, you know, an act that will inflame debate around the world, that you can win your case. Right? Ordinarily, I'm told that when you charge somebody with a federal crime in particular, you know, you have to have a very high percentage probability in your mind that you're going to win that case. Otherwise, you don't go ahead with it. Right? So then when you look at it before, so Trump was never indicted here. Right? And the standard isn't that you go to this process and you say, well, I have one choice. I can exonerate 100% or I can charge. That is absolutely not the way it works. After all, we go back to base principles. He's innocent until proven guilty. You looked at the evidence as prosecutors. You decided to decline to prosecute. And ordinarily, that's it. There's no explanation. Okay? You get a declination letter and you move on. Now, this idea that Mueller's role was to assemble evidence to turn it over to Congress to decide whether to impeach the president is rubbish. That is not the way it works. And then you move then to the question of impeachment. If this process that we've been through for 22 months has resulted in a declination to prosecute Trump for anything, okay, then how could, using this evidence, one reach a conclusion, not that this is high crimes or misdemeanors, people like to throw that one out there, without beginning, the important portion of that sentence is treason, and there's a crime like treason, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. It's not parking tickets or high crimes, it's treason. Does this rise to the level of treason? And there's no way what we're talking about here. You have a declination to prosecute by the prosecutor, having declined to prosecute, there's no earthly way that Congress could, on this body of evidence, decide there's grounds for high crimes, which I would argue even higher than what they were looking at here. They were looking at collusion. Is that like treason? And they were looking at obstruction of justice. Is that like treason? I don't know. Again, I'm not a lawyer. So I think this is, you know, we have a country that is bitterly divided. We have a lot of people, particularly in major metropolitan media markets, who loathe Trump. And no matter what, it seems, just watching, you know, what's going on. Now, as we're on air, I think at 2:30, Naylor, Gerald Naylor, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, has already announced that he's going to hold a press conference. I doubt that's to say, you know, I've read the report and I'm fine with it. It's most likely to say, oh, urgent, we've got to have hearings now.
More hearings.
Yeah.
I want to come back to the parallel between Flynn and Craig coming out of two different administrations, but finding a nice place to land outside of the United States and earning a very lucrative living and not reporting it, allegedly.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to this? Because Craig's role was very instrumental in the Clinton Foundation's profitability and its ability to continue operating, as Flynn's role was to his clients. And we still don't know who his clients were and how it was that these people were able to get away with something that is supposed to be against the law. I mean, after all, there is the Foreign Agents Registration Act. They're supposed to report any kind of financial activity outside of the United States, helping clients achieve what, we don't know. Could you walk us through what you know of how Craig operated, although he did not report to the U.S. government under the terms of the Foreign Agents Registration Act, that is, in fact, was what his new life is as a consultant.
Right. Okay, so if we contrast the two, in the first instance, you know, you have let's deal with Flynn first. In Flynn, you have somebody who has very limited business experience. He's not a member of the bar. He is not expected not only to know the law, but to behave in a way where, you know, great lawyers like to avoid even the appearance of impropriety. Not breaking the law, but coming, they don't even want to come close to being fairly accused of maybe acting outside the law. So in the case of Flynn, I believe what he stands accused of is not Foreign Agents Registration Act offenses, I may have that wrong, but of lying to the FBI. And, you know,
yes.
Right? So that's slightly different. But I don't like this idea, particularly given the fact that we spend what we know about $725 billion or thereabouts per year in military stuff. I don't like the idea of setting up a system where our military are, compared to the corporate sector and the investment world, very poorly paid. Right? You have defense contractor CEOs are making $10 and $20 million a year, and the top general probably makes, I don't know, maybe $200,000, if that. So the temptation, you look at this and you're saying, you're the generals, you're putting together the recommendations, you see these various people retire and then go on the board of Northrop Grumman, or they're just making this stuff up, of the big defense contractors. The temptation is vast. You know, even for somebody who's ramrod straight, like Mike Flynn, and I might add that he's a Democrat, not a Republican, my understanding. You know, he has an exemplary military background. But the temptation for somebody like that who's given up himself, put his family through 30 years of hell, you know, worrying about his safety and all this kind of stuff. Now his kids are going to college or they're getting married or they need a home or whatever, and the defense contractor comes along and says, how'd you like a contract for $2 million a year, or how'd you like this, or how'd you like that? It's totally out of balance. Same thing in the regulatory sphere. We have, you know, we have people in government. Nobody in government makes anywhere near what these multinational investment firms or law firms or corporations pay their lawyers, their finance people. So, you know, of course you could get into a situation, as I say, everyone's human, you get married, you got kids, you got expenses, you've got 20 years experience in the Justice Department, and somebody comes along and says, hey, how'd you like to be a partner at Covington and Burling or Williams and Connolly or Skadden Arps or a place like that where you're going to make $3 million a year? You know, we just need you to go slow on this investigation here, or we need you to let the statute of limitations expire, or we need this, or we need that. So the temptation for corruption here is massive. And I'm not saying that Flynn is corrupt, but I'm saying that I think this whole system needs to be changed. When we think about, you know, the central role that Williamson Connolly plays, and there's a guy called Bob Barnett, who's a senior partner there, who specializes in getting, he brags about it on his web, on the website, getting, helping politicians make the transition to private life, i.e. getting book contracts. Now, you know, I'll just disclose, I'm working on a book. I have an agent. But, you know, when we get to it, I'm going to ask my agent, you know, what is the fair? Show me some market comparables to make sure that whatever I'm getting paid here is fair. The idea that, you know, let's pick on Laura Bush for a second. The idea that Laura Bush, who was, I believe, represented by Bob Barnett, as was, I think, George W., that they should walk out with gigantic book contracts that are off the market, that are way different than what even, you know, a well-known author who had a record and reputation for producing exemplary work. You know, the idea that people should get huge advances for effectively ghost-written books, where the ghostwriter makes $200,000 and Bill Clinton makes $12 or $15 million, that is inherently corrupt. For many reasons, the publishing interest is industry is concentrated, and you know, here's Greg Craig working as a partner with Bob Barnett and David Kendall, you know, and then making the transition to Skadden Arps, but getting involved while at Williamson Connolly in this business is taking, by their own admission, financially bankrupt Clintons and turning them into multimillionaires in part by getting book advances. In the case of Barack Obama, he'd gotten into the book business, you know, in law school, but never got the type of advance that I believe the two of them just got recently. I think they got $65 million for, I believe it's just a book each, combined $65 million. That's so far off the market. You know, there should be a standard, and that we should be thinking through in this day and age. In 1979, when we were locked in a Cold War, when neither India nor China had begun the path of entering the market-based system, the U.S. was fundamentally internally focused. Yeah, our big companies had operations abroad. Very few people had investments outside the U.S. Today, we're the biggest unified market in the world. Every dodgy person around the world knows that the President of the United States, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of the Treasury, Attorney General of the United States, these are very powerful people who can make your life really good and make your life really bad. So and not just our country, but people like our president, powerful people who make economic decisions that can pain you or help you, we haven't thought through the proper way to transition those people out of office. So you get a situation, as may have happened with Barack Obama. You know, Barack Obama and Michelle Obama got their book deal, I believe, via Williamson Connolly. It was announced shortly after they left. Okay? What role? Williamson Connolly was representing, in the Vol Files, was their practice. David Kendall was representing, leading the defense of Hillary Clinton, the investigation into mishandling classified information that began on July 10th, 2015, before the primaries. Okay? Don't tell me that there wasn't pressure, you know, to dampen down the investigation of Hillary Clinton and to consider setting up this insurance policy to go after Trump, and that Williamson Connolly had nothing to do with that. Just don't even try to make that case, because I don't believe it. And this whole system, you know, of allowing people to basically trade off their political influence at a time when this country is now spending almost $7 trillion a year on government, state, local, federal, when we have $22 trillion in debt, who knows how many tens of trillions of unfunded additional liabilities that aren't our books, which are frankly not audited properly. The idea that we would have a system based in Washington where people in both parties look at this as a honeypot, as a treasure trove to, you know, trade off their political influence and become multimillionaires is repugnant to me. And I don't care whether you're a Bush or a Clinton, whether you're an Obama or a Biden or, you know, you pick it, or a Romney. I don't care. It's wrong. It's wrong at all times, but it's especially wrong when we have the crippling debt and financial obligations that we do have in this time of great uncertainty for us all. So
I want to come back to Greg Craig, who comes out of the Clinton administration and obviously kept close to the Clintons as they transitioned into their foundation. What do you know of his continuing role in the Clinton Foundation?
I don't know that he has a role in the Clinton Foundation, but I believe he was paid. We don't yet know exactly how much money, whether it was all the $4 million by this oligarch based in Ukraine, Viktor Pinchuk, there was a story in the Epoch Times, and I contacted the writer and mentioned that he should correct a few things in it. Viktor Pinchuk and his wife, who I think his wife is the daughter of one of the previous leaders of Ukraine, have, by their own admission, given $10 to $25 million towards the Clinton Foundation. Work involving Ukraine and the Clinton Foundation began in 2004, was memorialized in 2005, was focused on fighting HIV/AIDS in Ukraine, something that the Clinton Foundation has never lawfully been authorized to do. So there's a long-standing connection between the Pinchuks. I think his wife goes by Elena Franchuk, is her maiden name. I may have that wrong. But that connection is deep. It goes all the way back to about 2004, 2005, when Mr. Craig became involved working for the Pinchuk Foundation and the Ukrainians. I don't know. I believe the indictment from memory dates back just a few years, so I don't know if that involvement goes all the way back. I don't know how many other donors to the Clinton Foundation Mr. Craig may have represented or his firm. He was a partner after Williams & Connolly with a very prominent firm called Skadden Arps. That is a firm that has a large number of clients around the world. So how many of those people may have been Clinton Foundation donors, I have no idea. But, you know, to me, the swamp, you know, maybe it's impossible to drain the swamp. Maybe the conclusion you have to reach about this is it's time to do what Brazil did. It's time to do what other countries have done when they reach this impasse. It's time to, you know, turn Washington, D.C. into Williamsburg, make it a place where people go to look at historical monuments, think cleverly about where to site a new capital, and, you know, go to a very different approach where you don't have a small city with, you know, that's split inside the city, 90% Democrat, where if you're going to try somebody, as they were saying, they were, you know, as Jerry Corsi has said on television, and I'll admit he's a friend of mine, you know, he was threatened. He's now 72. He was told, you know, according to him, by the prosecuting attorney, we are going to try you in Washington, D.C., where they hate you, and you're going to go to jail for 25 years. That's not a system that any of us wants to see, whether it's Democrats doing it to Republicans or Republicans doing it to Democrats. So, you know, maybe it's not possible to drain this Washington, D.C. swamp and environs. Maybe we have to, you know, put the Capitol in the middle of Iowa or something like that, start from scratch. But right now the system is, you know, is gamed, and I believe we're seeing the Trump reaction to this already, and I don't know how long this is going to last. They're already talking about flipping the tables on the investigators. As a guess, that tension and acrimony is going to rise.
Well, it's going to be literally a bifurcated country, because people will then feel the need to choose sides, and they'll be encouraged to do so. But, you know, I can't help but think that we also have to see the role. I mean, these developments didn't just happen on their own. We had people who, you know, who started it, who created this new system. And there is no denying that under Trump, he's been in office for only 2 years. But he signaled his tenancy in the White House signaled a dark turn for the country, I think, in terms of how people feel about government, the relationship between government and the people, the the feeling among people that, you know, government is beyond corrupt, that there are people, a small group of people who get all the goodies, and everybody else is working and not seeing the benefits of their work. It's a very dark time psychologically for America. America is not a happy place for too many people right now.
Well, you know, I don't know, Teresa. I acknowledge that many people are unhappy, and I am sorry to hear that. But, you know, I look at it very differently. I'm a numbers guy, which may be why I look at things differently. And, you know, I think we've had a system where the one sector of our gigantic economy, the largest economy in the world, that has not been disrupted, you know, where in this broadcast that we're doing now, we could not have done in 1979 the way we're doing it, right? And the cost of certain things have gone way down. Costs of other things have gone way up. Administrative, you know, expenses are gigantic in government. They should not be. We don't even get a fair accounting of the governments. We don't get the kind of semi-strict accounting that, you know, led me to be able to spot the problems I saw in GE. You don't get a report like that. Every American deserves an actual common sense report, not one of these things like, you know, you get a pill bottle and you get that little thing, that the warning thing, and you got to have put a gigantic microscope together to figure out what the hell is on the small print of that thing. No, a common sense explanation of, for every dollar of tax revenue that you paid, not just in income tax, but in property tax, sales tax, et cetera, where did that money go? Who benefited from it? We don't get any of that out of government. And the spending is outrageous. We spent $7 trillion in 2018 on government, according to the government. That's bigger than the fairly priced, I think the only economy that may be around the same size as that is China. But I question their accounting for their GDP. I don't know that it's as reliable as you might think. There's no other economy that comes close to that spending, $7 trillion, that we spend on government. And, you know, I think we should all be very disappointed for what we get out of that. That's on the negative. On the positive, you know, maybe these statistics are all wrong, but unemployment is very low. The number of job openings is very high. Unemployment is low not just for white people. It's low for, you know, all ethnic groups, historic lows. It's low for women. You've got a climbing, you know, worker participation rate. There's been a lot of good that has been accomplished from a numbers standpoint in a short period of time by a president who hardly, you can forget a honeymoon period. I mean, he had a typhoon period from the very beginning, nonstop negativism across the media complex. And despite all that, you know, I think there have been many positive developments. And so I'm not as negative.
He created that. This was his reputation from the beginning, even before he was president. He was known in New York as a rather unpleasant person and, you know, a classic capitalist in the worst sense of the word. So he didn't go into the White House with a trail of great things following him. He was really known in New York for his predatory presence in the city of New York.
Well, you know, I grew up in New York too, and I would say yes, he was particularly in his 20s, 30s, and 40s. He was vulgar and crude and brash. You know, unbelievably brash, and rubbed a lot, and worse, and rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. But you look, and again, I focus on not words but numbers, and you look at the state the economy was in, and it was not in a good place when he took over. And you look at where it is now, and may still not be in a good place. The life is fragile and perilous right now. There are a lot of dangers lurking around the world and rising around the world. I'm not trying to say everything's fine. But when you just focus on numbers, on unemployment, on wages, on after-tax wages, you know, the stock market, I think the stock market prices are artificially inflated. I'm concerned about that. One number I'm terribly concerned about is debt, not just at the government level, but the student debt per student, and the you know, consumer debt is very high. Mortgages are still very high. Americans borrow too much. So I'm, as a numbers guy, I've got some concerns. But I think progress has been made in a short period of time.
Well, we will see. Quick, as we wrap up, what do you think is going to happen next with this report?
Well, I think there is going to be, I see it already, that the Trump reaction to say, all right, you know, why did this report, what conflicts of interest may have led this process to start in the first place? And we've spent a lot of time, and thank you for giving me the platform, Yatrice, talking about the Clinton Foundation corruption, its evolution into the largest unprosecuted selection of, collection of slush funds in the country. Robert Mueller investigated, or he was personally briefed, I think, in 2002, but he was head of the FBI. He likely was kept abreast of what should have happened beginning when he started on the 4th of September 2001 till he left the 4th of September 2013, and he did not see this obvious fraud. Rod Rosenstein was in the Justice Department for, I think, 4 or 5 years. He did not see, and he was in charge of prosecuting tax frauds. He didn't see this. James Comey was specifically put in charge of the Clinton Foundation investigation. It took over in January of 2002, and he didn't notice that the thing had never been audited, never complied with the law, wasn't validly organized, wasn't operating properly, and that it started doing stuff internationally when it never had any authority to do that. Those are the three people who I would give, you know, the most credit, in quotes, to spurring this investigation, which sure looks to me as a way of obstructing a real investigation into the Clintons. And I think that is what, and frankly, the Obamas, for failing to bring this Clinton Foundation to heel when they could have done it in by January, on and after January 20, 2009. I think the focus of the Justice Department may already be on some of these matters, as there's been a lot of noise made, not simply by me, but by many others. And, you know, in theory, the IRS has been investigating this since July of 2016. What have they been doing? In theory, the FBI since January of 2018. What have they been doing? We may find out answers to those questions very soon.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. As always, very illuminating. And we hope that we can count on you to come back again very soon with some more details as to how the so-called investigation into the Clinton Foundation is progressing, if at all. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Charles.
Thank you, Yatrice.
And that brings us to the end of our program today. Tomorrow, we'll join each other again for Free Your Mind Friday. Bye-bye.